This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fricke, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of July 31st, here are a few top stories. In the news, there are water issues in Gilbert. Here's the show's Mark Brody.
If you live in Gilbert, you might have gotten an unwelcome notice in the mail this week. About 40,000 households in the town received a notice this month with their water bill that said their drinking water contained higher than allowed level of a contaminant, according to the Arizona Republic. The contaminant is linked to cancer risks and other health problems if consumed at high levels for long periods of time. The town says the levels might exceed EPA standards, but it's still safe. And joining us now to talk about this is Andrew Jackson, water manager for the town of Gilbert. Andrew, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So the exposure, we understand, is limited. Are you recommending, though, that anyone seek medical attention? Is there anything that people should be on the lookout for to maybe go see a doctor?
No. Essentially, the US EPA sets the standard for the maximum contaminant levels for TTHMs. And if there are health concerns that you may have, or if you have questions about the particular contaminant level in regards to your health, then we would just advise that you would speak to your health advisor.
What kind of community reaction? Yeah, I'm sorry, I wanted to jump in, though. What kind of community reaction do you get from residents in Gilbert when it comes to this sort of thing? Because based on what you're saying, based on EPA standards, does it in any way send a little shudder through the community to have this in their mailbox?
Yes, it will cause a little bit of a shudder, but we're trying to be as transparent as we can with the information as it becomes available. And so we're essentially posting information on our Gilbert Digital Newsroom. We've identified all the areas that are in our system that we do compliance sampling, excuse me. And we're just trying to be as transparent with the information as we can.
Do you have a sense of what caused this, why these levels got to where they're at?
Yeah, so at one of our particular compliance sampling areas, we have a water reservoir that has mechanical mixing equipment. And so we have mechanical equipment that is in a reservoir that is used to reduce the number of TTHMs in our system. In October of 2016, at one of our reservoir sites, we had a mechanical failure that we were not aware of immediately because the equipment is actually housed in the reservoir itself. When we were made aware of the failure, we immediately took action to mitigate that failure, and we've since put measures in place to ensure that that doesn't happen again.
So, Andrew, that was a design flaw initially, that something that maybe people, the planners, didn't quite figure out, and that was a problem that they hadn't anticipated happening?
There was somewhat of a design flaw in the mechanism that we had, so we ended up replacing spray nozzles on a device that's used to spray water within the reservoir to mix the water. And so the nozzles became clogged, and it caused the device to essentially malfunction. And so it wasn't working as intended.
Andrew, I think for people maybe not in government, they hear that levels are maybe higher than EPA standards, but it's still safe to drink, in this case with water. For people who are maybe not familiar with how that stuff works, how should we reconcile that levels are higher than they should be, but it's not unsafe to be drinking this water?
Yeah, so TTHMs, the EPA standard for TTHMs is set to where if a human consumes water with high levels of TTHMs over the course of a lifetime, essentially, they would be at an increased risk of cancer. And so this, we like to reiterate that the water is safe and that it's not an acute situation that people need to be concerned about.
All right, that's Andrew Jackson, water manager for the town of Gilbert. Andrew, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And up next, from KJZZ's The Show, here's host Steve Goldstein.
The San Francisco peaks in northern Arizona are among the more attractive places for hikers to venture in the state, and a cornucopia of plant species and natural growth for botanists to explore. In fact, more than 800 plant species can be found there. In the August issue of Arizona Highways magazine, the story called Where the Wild Orchid Grows by Annette McGivney digs into a number of those species as she hikes with botanist Glenn Rink, and the two of them join me. Now, Glenn, Annette calls you a guerrilla botanist in the very first line of the story. What do you make of that description, and how would you define it?
Well, people have brought that up to me in the last couple of weeks, and I think she's referring to the fact that I'm going to places that most other botanists don't want to go to. So that's deep, wet canyons, cold places, brushy places, steep, nasty things that most people that live in cities would never consider going to, usually without any trails.
But has that allowed you to make some really fascinating discoveries because you've gone to places other people won't?
Absolutely. It's allowed me to carve a niche for myself in the botanical research world.
So Annette, from hanging out with Glenn for the amount of time that you did, how much do you feel like you learned exponentially about what it takes to find these sometimes elusive plants?
I learned a lot. I learned a lot about how to recognize plants from their flowers and from their leaves and kind of, you know, getting into the details of the characteristics of the plants and watching Glenn collect plants in the field and press them and seeing how not only was he, you know, just looking at the leaves, but he was actually like looking at the roots and kind of looking at the plant as a whole organism and all the different parts of it made me appreciate kind of the level of detail you need to have in order to properly identify plants.
Generally, could you describe what the plant life on the San Francisco Peaks is like?
It's pretty unique. There's five species of sedge that grow on the San Francisco Peaks that don't grow anywhere else in the state. These are things that are coming down from the Rocky Mountains. So in some senses, the San Francisco Peaks are a southern extension of the Rocky Mountains. People do get up on the peaks quite a bit. It's not snow-covered throughout the year. There's always something new to discover, despite the fact that people are all over the place up there. It's not to say that you can't take a hike up on the peaks kind of off-trail, and you're not going to run into anybody. But there's always something new to discover. On this trip with Annette, there was a young man along who was not a botanist, and we stopped at a pond early in the day, and he noticed a plant that I had never noticed before. And so different sets of eyes are really valuable.
Going off what Glenn said, that the peaks are such a unique environment. You know, we have like this alpine ecosystem here in Arizona, and with it comes so many unique plants. And that was sort of my motivation with the story, was knowing that it was a unique ecosystem. But obviously, I didn't have the scientific expertise to appreciate, you know, how that manifested in the vegetation. And so getting to go hiking with Glenn was such an amazing experience for me.
And Annette, not only do you get into the ecosystem, you write so much about how important that area is to so many Native Americans as well, and the different uses for the plants. Could you describe some of those? Because there is a fascinating connection that some of the people you spoke with have to what is grown on the peaks.
Some of the rare plants have medicinal uses to the indigenous people of northern Arizona, but also some of the very common plants like yarrow and other things that, you know, that we see, but we, you know, in non-native culture aren't aware of all the different medicinal and ceremonial uses, like wild tobacco being gathered, harvested from the peaks and taken to the Hopi mesas for ceremonies. We sometimes look at plants more from a scientific perspective, but the indigenous cultures actually view the plants more as part of their cultural identity. That's, you know, very much a part of them and their history. So those plants are very much a part of their tradition, even for tribes that aren't located right at the peaks, but they come to the peaks to gather the plants.
Guys, let's talk a little bit about the graceful buttercup and the hunt for it. And there's one line in your story, Annette, where it says, "The graceful buttercup is stealthy. Its growing season is short, and it blooms during the peak of the monsoon when hiking up to the plant's possible hiding places is treacherous due to lightning danger."
Oh, well, so the graceful buttercup, I was just originally drawn to it because of its name. And for me, these little plants that before I investigated this story, you know, I would see these delicate little flowers high up on the peaks, poking through the rocks, and I would kind of admire their tenacity and their beauty in a very delicate and harsh environment. And And so the graceful buttercup really captured my imagination, if only because of its name. And so it kind of gave me something to focus on as far as I really want to try and find this plant, but it's hard and you've got to know where to look. And it really helps if you have someone who's able to recognize its tiny little green leaves, especially if it's past the flowering stage. It's almost impossible for a novice, I would say, to recognize it, you know, when it doesn't have the flower, because it's so complicated to and easy to confuse it with other plants that are similar. So I was sort of focused on the graceful buttercup. Glenn, maybe not so much, because he doesn't really focus on common names at all, I learned, with plants. He is more interested in uses the scientific names like any scientist would.
Glenn, forgive me for not using the scientific name, but another one that you and Annette came across was the Franciscan bluebell, which, Annette, in your story you described that it tastes like spinach. And Glenn, apparently you just grabbed some and you started eating it and then offered it to Annette. How did that go?
The bluebells doesn't really smell, and it tastes about like spinach. And we did eat some while we were up there.
Well, that's what I thought was great, too. And obviously having someone with your knowledge there. But I was thinking to myself, even I would really have to trust Glenn and Annette on this one to say, yeah, it tastes like spinach. Yeah, well, sure it does. Why not? Right, have some. But did you trust him right away to try that?
I did. I have heard about Glenn. He's kind of a legend, at least in northern Arizona, for his knowledge of plants and his determination to hike into crazy places to find them. And so I definitely trusted him on different levels, and I knew he had the experience that if he was going to put something in his mouth and eat it, I was safe to eat it too. I'm not a big edible kind of person on my hiking because I'm afraid of eating the wrong thing, but I knew with Glenn that I was safe, and it did taste like spinach.
Annette McGivney is a writer for Arizona Highways, and Glenn Rink is a botanist. We've been talking about Annette's article called Where the Wild Orchid Grows.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In the world of business, this week we took an in-depth look at jobs and wages in our series Phoenix at Work. Here is one of the stories. 8 years after the Great Recession ended, we're seeing low unemployment, but many workers aren't seeing their paychecks increase much. As part of the series, KJZZ's business correspondent Christina Estes reports on one group hit especially hard.
This is the control panel, basically.
Kirill Motenko is on a mission.
I have no background in this at all.
After years working as a meat cutter, Motenko is learning to cut metal. More precisely, how to tell a machine to do it.
From the blueprints, you basically take that and make the measurements, which ones you need, and then you have to write that into the code.
Motenko is part of the precision machining program at Gateway Community College in Phoenix. When he graduates, he'll be considered a middle-skilled worker. That's someone with an education beyond high school, but less than a bachelor's degree.
Keep your right hand on the red button.
Between 2007 and 2015, the Brookings Institution found median earnings for all workers in Arizona fell 9%, while earnings for middle-skilled workers dropped more than 13%. The report suggests a healthy middle class will require workers to focus on specific areas that are in demand, like precision machining.
If you have the skill sets and you have the stick-to-itiveness and that perfectionist in you, you will be able to make money.
Michael Case helps run the program at Gateway College.
The last numbers that I saw, that on average, a machinist across the country was making about 52,000 a year.
The loss of manufacturing jobs weighs heavy on many minds. A Pew Research Center survey last year found 80% of people consider outsourcing of jobs to other countries to be the greatest harm to American workers. But economist Jim Hunsinger thinks there's a bigger threat.
Most of the technological improvements in our economy are not driving job creation. They're kind of job killers.
While speaking at the Economic Outlook 2017 event organized by the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce, Hunsinger uses Amazon as an example.
Technology has allowed Amazon to be massively creating value in terms of market cap for their shareholders, but not employing very many people. They're doing it. They're leveraging technology, not people.
He says one of the greatest economic challenges will be figuring out how to grow our technology prowess while also creating jobs.
The demarcation in our society is going to be those that have skills and those that don't.
It's one reason many business, education, and public policy leaders support Achieve 60 AZ. The initiative's goal is to get 60% of working-age Arizonans to hold certificates or college degrees by 2030. Right now, it's 42%.
Our educational attainment is below average now. It used to be above average.
ASU Professor Tom Rex says Arizona's per-pupil spending, teachers' salaries, and educational attainment were well above average until about 1970. He thinks raising taxes to fund education will lead to more prosperity.
Yeah, you can argue all these other things that don't involve money, but what is it that's going to improve the quality of schools without a real boost in money? You're going to point at that teacher who's making $40,000 a year, is criticized roundly by lots of people as doing a poor job, and they're just going to miraculously decide they're going to become the super teacher? Is that really going to happen?
Changing perceptions is one goal of the Maricopa Community College District. It created business and industry leadership teams to help establish a pipeline of skilled workers. Chancellor Maria Harper-Marinick.
There are jobs in areas that somehow are not attractive to, for example, a lot of young people. That is something we need to own together. So there's some areas where there is jobs and we need to message why those jobs are important, what great career opportunities they present.
Okay. I want you to turn your coolant off.
When he was younger, Kirill Matenko never gave machining much thought. But after working various service jobs, the 33-year-old is ready for a career.
Push start.
A career he knows will require continuing education to keep up with technology and employer expectations.
I look forward to it, actually.
Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You can find the other stories in the series at work.kjzz.org. The Trump administration announced plans this week to lift environmental restrictions for land along a section of the U.S.-Mexico border in order to begin building a new segment of wall. From the Fronteras Desk, KJZZ's Michelle Marisco reports.
Customs and Border Protection wants to start work on a 14-mile segment of primary border fence in San Diego. That was part of what the president requested in a budget approved in the House last week. But to start, a CBP spokesman said in an email that first the planned area needs a geotechnical study. Under a normal process, that would require an environmental impact report, and that would push the scheduled project back. So the Trump administration announced it is implementing an exemption specifically to the National Environmental Policy Act. It's the first time DHS under Trump has used the exemption. President Barack Obama never implemented it. President George Bush did so at least five times. Dan Millis is with the Sierra Club in Tucson.
It's the largest waiver of law in United States history, this border waiver. We've got more than three dozen laws off the books. It's been more than 10 years. These laws have never been put back on the books. There's no sunset date for when these waivers expire.
The agency is already being sued for not determining the environmental impact of its wall project. Michel Marisco, KJZZ News, Tucson.
For the first time in the U.S., scientists have genetically modified human embryos. The technique could screen out heritable diseases, but many worry about where it might ultimately lead. From the Arizona Science Desk, KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbis reports.
Healthier humans or designer babies? A natural question after the successful editing of unimplanted human embryos by Oregon Health and Science University. Arizona State University's James Collins, an expert on gene drives, says the work takes us another step down a problematic path.
It continues to raise this question about how far does one go? How do you make these decisions? Who gets to make these decisions?
Using a genetic search and replace tool called CRISPR-Cas, the team cut a mutated gene linked to hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, a heart muscle disease. In most cases, the DNA then pasted in a non-mutated copy. The team notably avoided the pitfalls that afflicted three previous Chinese studies, such as off-target edits and mosaicism, in which embryos contain both edited and unedited cells. But perhaps its greatest import lies in the fact that it affects hereditary DNA, as ASU's Andrew Maynard explains.
We're rewriting the genome in a way which is inheritable across generations. So we're actually doing now what obviously evolution has done over millions of years, but we're doing it in the lab, in the test tube.
Many hurdles remain, but for now, the technique raises questions about whether gene research will soon outpace our efforts to regulate it. Nicholas Gerbus, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischmann, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.